This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by J-Food-O, dedicated to sharing the best Japan has to offer. Over the next few months, J-Food-O and a selection of London restaurants will create seafood and sake pairings for spectator listeners to help develop your knowledge and enjoyment of the drink. The pairing will focus on the concept of umami, which in Japanese means the essence of deliciousness.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Lara Prendergast.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Ed Smith. Ed is an award-winning food writer, and after a career in law, he retrained as a chef and began his acclaimed blog, Rocket and Squash. He's been shortlisted for numerous awards and won the Fortnum & Mason Best Online Restaurant Writer in 2015. He published his first cookbook, On the Side, in 2017, and the Borough Market cookbook followed shortly afterwards. His latest book, Crave, Recipes Arranged by Flavour to Suit Your Mood and Appetite, will be published at the end of May. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Ed, as listeners know, we always start this podcast in the same place with a question. What are your earliest memories of food?
My earliest memories, I would say it's not quite a sitting on Nonna's knee podding peas moment, but it is to do with helping Mum, this has probably been said many times, cook a Sunday roast. I'm from Worcestershire. We had a big garden with an orchard and a vegetable patch, although that was generally overgrowing and the apples were falling. But Sunday lunch was always something we did. And I learned that if I helped Mum make the gravy or help make the pudding, then I basically got out of washing up, which my brothers had to do.
And what were mealtimes like in your family?
So I've got three brothers and we're all pretty closely grouped in age, which meant that every meal was a family meal around the dinner table, with four boys aggressively claiming that another had had one piece of penne pasta more than the other. So mum was incredibly good at portioning, and that's probably a talent that I've inherited.
And was your mum the main cook in your house growing up?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, mum's the cook. Although I think over time and my brothers took over much of the... She won't be happy with me saying it, but we took over plenty of the cooking. Mum went back to work when I was about 10, 11, I think, and we quickly learnt that if we wanted to eat earlier than when Mum or Dad got home, we had to first put food on that had been pre-made, and then gradually we'd start making the food as well. So I think we've all got a healthy interest in food and in cooking.
And what sorts of dishes was your mum cooking, apart from the roasts?
It's pretty standard 1980s home cooking. So there were plenty of spaghetti bolognese, chili con carnes, which is essentially the same dish in those times.
With kidney beans added.
chili powder put in one and some kidney beans. Cottage pie, again, same base, potatoes on top. So your family meals were looking at now, as I'm kind of having my own family as well, you can see how you do things that you can get done ahead or that can be put on to cook while everyone's being marshalled around. But Mum was also quite into, I guess, dinner parties. And I think she is an entertainer, so would be always looking to cook a meal for her friends that would impress or that everyone could talk about. So I think pretty much every dinner party was a different meal from a different recipe book. That kind of cook, I would say.
And what about at school? What was school food like for you?
School food, packed lunches until I was about 13, which I didn't love. I think Dad was in charge, actually, of packed lunches, and I was famous for hiding my sandwiches in various parts of the lunchbox or shoes or pockets because I didn't want to eat them. And I don't think that's because I didn't like food. Then when we had school food, it was usual affair. I remember really loving puddings, steamed puddings with treacle or jam rolls, that kind of stuff, lots of custard, which weirdly we always got served before sports matches, which I don't think helped the results.
And after you left school and went to university, you were at Durham. What was student food like? Did you cook much there?
So I think probably, and I don't want to say this out of turn, but I think probably unusually for kind of an 18-year-old back in, when was that, 2000, I was really well versed at cooking for lots of people already at that age, having been, you know, cooking with a family of six for years. So after the first year in halls, you know, it was absolutely no, I don't think I ate like a student, or the classic example of a of a student. I ate the same food that mum had taught us, or I'd basically picked up from watching Ready, Steady, Cook at the time. So I just cooked normal, nice food.
And were you aware, sort of in that period before you went to university, when you were at home and absorbing food knowledge and learning from your mum, were you aware of this growing interest in food, or was it subconscious? How did it manifest?
Definitely. I think what I touched upon it just there, really, with Ready, Steady, Cook, which I would sort of happily say was a formative experience of my cooking. And TV chefs around that time, I guess, beginning with, for me, Delia, and then a bit of River Cottage, and Jamie obviously was big when I was 15, 16. And I think that I'm sure that Jamie's programmes influenced me of what I wanted to cook, and the fact that I like cooking. I used to make tarts from his first book for my parents' friends, sold a few of those at that age. So I was already into cooking, and I knew that I liked it, and I would sneak off to watch food programmes. They would be right up there with any of the programmes that I wanted to watch, and read the food pages at the back of the Times on a Saturday from, you know, as long as I remember. So I was aware that I liked food, but it was never crossed my mind that it would be a career at that point. I was good at school, good at university, and I don't think at that point it felt like a kind of industry that I should jump into. And also, it's not one that I had any experience of. My mum was a solicitor, so it was a kind of an obvious move for me when I started thinking about careers at sort of first, second year of university.
And you then became a solicitor. What was food like then when you first started working as a lawyer?
Well, working as a lawyer, that was when I first moved to London, and that was 2007. And that, if you look back at the kind of a timeline of London restaurants, is broadly around the time of street food starting up and restaurants becoming the new rock and roll and a much improved restaurant scene. And so I was very aware of great restaurants, apparently great restaurants, reading reviews, but I wasn't finding the time to book them, largely because of being a junior lawyer. So my experience of food was wanting to go to the places that I was telling other people to go to and not having the time. And that's really why I started my blog, which I did sort of as I qualified as a solicitor. And that was as a creative outlet to go to those restaurants, to make me go, and I wanted to write about them just because I wanted to do something other than review regulatory papers. And and also to cook something new every weekend, because it was definitely something I was aware that I enjoyed doing, but I was finding that I was getting to the weekends absolutely shattered with no plans. And being the kind of slightly OCD nature that I had and maybe still have, I needed something to be a kind of ball and chain to book those restaurants and to cook that food.
And what do you think makes a good restaurant review?
Good question. I'm of the opinion that restaurant reviews are not academic papers on the food that's in the restaurant. It's a relatively subjective experience, and one that most people that read that review won't experience themselves. So there's an element of entertainment and intrigue. So I think that the review needs to be entertaining and to hold the interest, but also to be based on the opinion of someone who does have a decent palate, who can recommend or dislike food and explain why that's the case. So it's a mix of everything, but I do like a bit of entertainment thrown in.
And tell us about the decision to leave law in favour of food. Was it an easy decision, a snap decision? How did it come about?
So I'd started this blog, which is, again, I don't know who listening will be into the London blog scene of 2010-11, but I was a sort of a secret anonymous blogger. I felt a bit ashamed by having this website on the sly. Certainly didn't tell any of my colleagues. And I, like I said, I did it as a creative outlet, with no intention to do anything else. It happened to get read, I think, which was exciting and interesting, and to see people reading it and responding to it. And I found that I was writing these blog posts at 12 o'clock at night, having got home at 11. And I distinctly remember stopping myself at 2 o'clock in the morning, saying, you know, what are you doing? Why are you writing about Pierre Kaufman's pop-up on the top of Selfridges when you've got to be back at work in 5 hours' time? Maybe there's an industry that I'd rather work in. And it was not because I wanted to, or thought in particular at that point, I didn't specifically know what I wanted to do, but I knew that whatever you do in life, you have to work hard. And so it wasn't that I was necessarily sick of working hard. It's just that I maybe realised that there was a base interest that wasn't being fulfilled in financial disputes. and that I should maybe look to change what I was working. Now, what I didn't think I was going to do was become a full-time food writer. I thought I would start some sort of food business. To be totally transparent, I think I thought, oh, look, at Byron's a great example. I'm going to start a burger chain and flip it for millions of pounds in 4 years' time without much work. And it can't be hard to get the salary of an associate lawyer anytime soon. And so, yeah, I thought that, or I thought I might start a cookery school. And that's why I then jumped into my sort of safety net, really, was to go to catering college for 6 months. And that for me, the decision was made when I started looking around as to how I could make a move. This is slightly weird for having jumped from a good career to a nebulous and dodgy one, is I thought that I could make the risk less by going to catering college. In reality, what I was doing was fudging my decision and probably saying to mum and dad, look, I've got a plan.
It legitimised it, doesn't it? Because you're not just going off into the ether. You're saying, well, I have term dates and I'll probably have some homework. And it suddenly fits with the rest of your life.
Totally. And I thought that, you know, it was 4 days a week and I thought I'd be writing my business plan and getting experience on the fifth day. And that was all good. It was interesting, actually, when I resigned, the partner was... When you resign from a job, you always get that kind of initially hatred and anger. You go through the various stages of loss, I think, on the other side, don't you? And as soon as I said that I was changing career and going to catering college, the sort of the change in his demeanour was significant and obvious. And I think he said, oh, brilliant, you're following your passion. And I'm not sure I actually was. I think I was, in majority, had probably enough of the work that I was doing, and the food was a way to go, a different direction to go. And it felt like an interesting one at the time. Food 10 years ago was really becoming quite a big and a more legitimate area to move into. So yeah, Catering College was my crash mat.
And tell us about that. How is Catering College?
Great. I don't know if anyone is listening is really interested in this kind of stuff, but there are various institutions, as you know, as to where you might go. And one that I went to, Westminster, is the place that you normally do sort of 16 and 17 year olds go to spend 3 years to get a GMVQ or similar. Is it not even GMVQ, but a qualification that helps them sort of be an alternative to high school, mm-hmm. really. But the course I did was a 6 month course which crammed all that, essentially the same things into that 6 months, which they, I think, scrambled really to try and get students largely from Korea to come and pay much bigger course fees. They're going to love me for saying this. But actually, the year that I had, there were only four of us on the course. We had a vague objective every week. And after the first 6 weeks of the various skills, we basically got a different animal in at the start of the week, broke it down and cooked various things so that we then ticked off the curriculum throughout the week. So it was an absolutely brilliant experience, essentially one-on-one teaching without the pressure of being in a restaurant, without maybe some of the more formulaic rigour of some of the other courses. And for me, as at that point, a 30-year-old who wanted to change career but loved food, to cook something different every week in a professional kitchen layout with some support, but also an ability to do what you want. And at that stage, I felt like I was already a pretty good cook. So it wasn't necessarily learning how to cook, but I was developing new techniques or understanding a bit more about stuff that I'd been practicing for years.
And did you then spend time working in some of London's restaurants?
So I did a bit of experience during that time, and for about six to nine months after, working in some trendy places, I suppose, and a few of the Michelin star bits, but only to be honest, sort of stage type things, whilst also running pop-ups of my own. I ran like a 2 month pop-up in Kensington, of all places, where we had supper clubs come and host one or two nights a week of their own events, and I was there as the kind of firefighter and the guy running the kitchen, which is really interesting. And people like Asma Khan, who now runs Darjeeling Express, had her first ever pop-ups there. Mandy from Sambal Shock, which is a great laksa restaurant on Holloway Road. Lots of people that I still know now working in the London food scene, I met them, which is great.
And you've obviously been sort of witnessing what's happened in London over the last decade or so. What have been the kind of biggest changes that you've noticed?
There was this thing called the pandemic.
Apart from that.
About a year ago. No, it was actually quite interesting, because for me it does bookend about 10 years of really being quite interested in the London food scene. And 2008, with the financial crisis, at that time I was working as a trainee in a structured finance department at my law firm, Freshfields, and we acted for the Bank of England as everything broke down. So I sort of saw that. And that's interesting because I now can correlate the experience of street food and people sort of coming out of restaurants and doing their own thing at a much younger age than they had traditionally done, because finance had gone and because people, restaurants were closing and opening, and chefs had an opportunity to sort of break out with the vans. And I think that the scene then matured, and things that were done that were extremely exciting in 2011 in restaurants. I did a stage at, I worked with two guys who now have quite famous restaurants, one called Lyle's, one called the Clove Club. They had a pop-up called the Young Turks, and that was my first ever restaurant experience for about 2 months. From then on, lots of other young chefs started opening restaurants, essentially following this kind of modern British / Nordic style of cooking. And everything's always, you know, hype-driven and new restaurant-driven, and suddenly we get to the COVID pandemic when I think some of that was maturing and maybe had stopped for me being any kind of really interesting places, not any, many really interesting places opening up. And I think what we're seeing now with COVID is that, again, there'll be lots of these spaces and lots of young professionals who maybe have now got an opportunity, who've in the last 6 to 9, 12 months have had their own businesses selling pies or selling Borex, and they're suddenly going to break out of the traditional mould of being a restaurant chef much quicker than they might have done had COVID not happened. But actually, maybe that's just another decade cycle about to start all over again. Does that make sense? I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling.
Yeah, that does make sense. It feels like there is a space now that there wasn't before. And I think when I wasn't in London or in the food scene at that 2008 point, but I followed blogs avidly, and I can see in retrospect what you are now describing happening. And I think you're right. There feels like there is an opportunity for businesses that perhaps have tiny overheads and have been able to experiment during this unprecedented time.
Exactly.
As we like to continually call it. I mean, personally, I really hope that they will succeed. I think there are a lot of incredibly interesting and diverse businesses and business models that have come out of the delivery year we've been living in, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I just think there's sort of a new there will be, as well as the traditional, the established restaurants trying to find their feet again, which, you know, goodness, that's going to be hard for them all to do if they've managed to weather the last 12 months. They're essentially starting new restaurants. We're basically going to have, it's going to feel like every single one of those 10 years all rolled into 5 weeks as every new restaurant essentially tries to reannounce itself. And I think there's lots of appetite, not just in London, but everywhere in Britain, to go back to eating in restaurants and to not cook for yourself. So it's a great time to be releasing a cookbook. But I think there's lots of appetite for people to do that sort of thing and goodwill, but presumably only it's going to be hard for everyone to get to where they were, I think. Yet at the same time, anyone starting from scratch has got an amazing opportunity. Mm.
And tell us about having had experience in restaurants, how did you move into recipe writing in particular?
So I guess that's because I never really left. The blog was an amazing experience of finding a voice and learning how to write and to learn how to write recipes people might follow and be interested in. I worked in restaurants, I worked with other people, and I just realised that what I liked the most was being around the best people in the food, whether that's a producer or a customer or the bit everything else in between. And so I felt like I wanted to document that whilst at the same time writing my own recipes, because that's definitely the thing that I've enjoyed the most in this career is creating recipes and putting that into the shape, in particular, of books. And I guess it just kind of, I'd never let go of the blog side of things. And that gave me opportunities with writing and with recipe commissions and working with magazines that sort of gradually gravitated me more towards being a writer than trying to be a restaurant chef.
And who are the food writers who you like to read?
I like writers that set their recipes in the context that make me want to cook them and that provide a bit of background. So I like, it feels obvious to say, sort of Nigel Slater, Simon Hopkinson, and kind of a more recent ilk, Rachel Waddy, who are all literary in what they do, and as a result of that, I really feel immersed in the food. And often, actually, I'm not necessarily sure that I follow their recipes, but everything they do sparks a bit of interest or sparks a desire to cook something. They're writers, I guess, that often provide comfort. So my book that's coming out, it's got 6 flavour profiles in it, 2 of which, I suppose, are naturally comfort kind of food, rich and savoury and cheesy and creamy. And prior to setting in my own recipes into that space, or even doing so, people like Nigel Slater are the kind of people that on a rainy day, on a grey day, or in autumn, when I have a celeriac in front of me, it's kind of like, right, what would Nigel do right now? And I think that that's the kind of writer I look to, is someone who has a voice that I trust.
I think that leads us on to one of our questions we always ask, which is, what is comfort food for you?
So this is quite interesting, because of so much that we read about comfort, I sort of think of roast chicken, chicken soup, baked beans. But actually, I'm not sure that's right. I think, again, if I look to those days when I'm seeking comfort food, sometimes it is kind of a brothy, beany dish with some braised meat. But more often than not, actually, I find myself on a rainy day or when I'm feeling a bit glum or, frankly, hungover, something like a katsu curry is like the ultimate way to both let me kind of sink into the food, but also rev me up and stop me being moody.
Do you ever get sick of cooking?
Yeah. I do really love cooking, and if I'm sick of it, it doesn't last very long. But for example, during the first lockdown, we stayed legitimately at a house that's bigger than our flat. It didn't have a dishwasher. My son was 2.5, 3, and slightly difficult. And I was a bit stressed because it was the sort of first stage of getting deadlines for my book. And I was supposed to be cooking, you know, essentially a new dish every day for dishes that I couldn't actually buy the ingredients for. And I was doing all the washing up for some reason. And I think I was just at that point, it's like, right, someone get me a jack of potato and some baked beans, or someone get me a ready meal, because I'm done. And actually, whenever I finish a cooking project, that's pretty much the first meal as well that I turn to, sort of hand it in, having cooked 100 dishes 3 times over the last half a year. It's like, right, jack, potato, beans and cheese, some Tabasco sauce, thanks.
Has having a child changed the way you cook or eat or think about food?
Yeah, and again, in particular in the last year when there's just so much cooking to do and other things, we were without childcare for quite a long time, so it was really hard to try and fit work in amongst being a good parent and cooking and living. And I think I realised that the food that I cooked when I was a 30-year-old, recently changed career, thinking I was a chef, a restaurant chef style food, that I realised that was just a bit fiddly, really. And I think I really appreciate a recipe or just a style of cooking that is without faff, without unnecessary steps, which can still lead to a fantastic result and food that you love. But whether it's a dish that is one pot and can be served from the same dish, or just something that doesn't involve multi-steps, I think I'm definitely more appreciative of it now. I definitely experimental with him. He eats oysters and kimchi and lots of things. He's going to be a horrific foodie, hopefully. But he also, I realise, is his own person, has never touched a green leaf of any type, whether it's been pureed or is raw. And I sort of realised that there's an element of nutrition that's got to go in there, and there's also that he can have being control. And so there are lots of things that it's made me realise that my way is not the only way, and actually was maybe it was wrong as well.
And Ed, just to finish, we normally ask what your desert island meal would be.
Is the desert island hot?
It can be whatever you like it to be.
I think, bearing in mind I'm on an island, and yeah, I think it's going to be a really nice one. I think a really light starter, kind of a crudo, the fish from the sea with some olive oil and maybe a bit of citrus fruit and a herb on it, just to get me going. But the main course would be completely different and would probably be some of those braised butter beans that I mentioned earlier on, with some braised meat and a nice kind of perky salsa on top of it, just to liven it up. Finish with a Basque cheesecake and some poached rhubarb.
Oh, that is a good pudding. That is a very good pudding choice. I mean, it all sounds delicious, but I'm particularly into the pudding. It's also very trendy.
I know. I'm sort of hoping that's a trend that doesn't completely fade, or is actually, for anyone who's not into it, the last sort of 2 years, and in particular lockdown, Basque cheesecakes have been horrifically overexposed in food media. But actually, it's really nice, and it's a great cheesecake.
Yeah, it's incredibly delicious.
And it's a great cheesecake to make, because you literally just stick some custard in an oven and burn it. And it's almost as good as a Sara Lee cheesecake of the different mould.
Ed, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Ed's book, Crave, Recipes Arranged by Flavour to Suit Your Mood and Appetite, will be published by Quadril on the 27th of May.
Thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe. And if you've really enjoyed it, please do leave us a star rating and review. It really helps us out.